Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Vacation, it's Here and Now. The Pentagon is refusing to release additional photos of the atrocities at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. The government says their release could incite riots and violence against American interests around the world. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union is suing to force the Pentagon to release the pictures. Greg Mitchell of Editor and Publisher Magazine has been covering the case and joins us from New York. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Greg, nobody is disputing that the pictures exist. In fact, we heard Secretary Rumsfeld talk about them over a year ago, saying that these are more disturbing than some of the ones we've seen. What are in these pictures?
Well, according to what we've heard, and from a few people who have seen them and the videos as well, they actually are quite tougher. I mean, we have the testimony of some of the congressional representatives who have seen them, who have said they're actually worse than what has come out. So obviously there's something at stake here.
Something at stake. The Pentagon says quite a bit at stake, and that's why they're not going to release these additional photos that they say they should be suppressed because, quoting, here, riots, violence, and attacks by insurgents could follow their release. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that the Freedom of Information Act, which is what we're really going on here, is really based on the public's right to know and accountability of public officials. And you know, we have a situation here where, as bad as the situation might be with the release of these pictures and images, the fact remains that officials must be accountable, and that there is certainly a feeling in terms of public opinion, let's say, that the people who perpetrated these actions may have gotten off lightly. Very few people have been punished, and I think there's a sense that perhaps what's behind this refusal to release the images is not so much what could happen abroad, but that public opinion in the U.S. might be aroused against these people in the military and even in the Bush administration who have not paid any price for what happened at Abu Ghraib.
Well, in this case, we already know about Abu Ghraib. Is there a need to see more photos?
Well, I think particularly if the images are worse than what has come out, I think that there have been a lot of words written, but everyone knows that images can have more power than words. And, of course, that may be what the Pentagon is afraid of. But as the ACLU and others argue in this case, you know, we cannot have an open democracy. We cannot have a real accounting of what's happened there if we really don't know the full extent of what happened. And I think there's a sense that the Americans, while they were this was certainly fresh in their mind last year, that has faded, and that we must really see the full extent of what happened.
What would happen to the whole concept behind the Freedom of Information Act if this argument of the Pentagon's is to prevail? That is to say, that the consequences of becoming accountable are more than we can bear.
Well, I mean, I think there are arguments on both sides, but you know, as you know, the Freedom of Information Act is usually used in much lower profile situations, and you have local and state governments and federal agencies people don't even know much about. So it's become more routine, and the fact is that often what comes out is very important and very much in the public interest. If we let the officials call the tune on this, then it really is censoring what the public, who after all pays their salaries, you know, these are all public agencies, and it's not a matter of private industry or anything like that. So there's certainly, it's been well established in the courts and elsewhere that the press and the public has a right to know in most cases. So you'd have to have an incredibly important and all important principle of national security or something that could actually warrant withholding things.
What about the difference between the material that the government would release and then what the media should release in terms of good taste and judgment on their part?
Well, you know, we've done stories going back last year and before that the Washington Post, the editor of the Washington Post, you know, told us he's seen these, seen some of this material anyway. He told us at that time, as others have, that they have had images in their possession that they have not shown. I think the press has shown great restraint in terms of the war. In fact, we've criticized the press for overly censoring photos from Iraq. There have been very, very few photos that have run that have shown the real damage to American soldiers over there. And I think there's a sense that the public does not have a true understanding of the carnage and the, you know, how American soldiers have been blown apart over there. And so certainly the press and the media in general, I think, has shown great restraint in showing things like that. And I think even in the case of Abu Ghraib, as, you know, as bad as the images were that were published, just as many or more were held back. And those are the images the press already has. Yeah. They haven't even had most of what we're talking about in the current case.
Greg, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Greg Mitchell, editor and publisher of Editor and Publisher magazine from New York. Today, the trials and tribulations of being your own lawyer. It's a growing trend in the nation's courtrooms, average Americans representing themselves. The Administrative Office of U.S. Courts says there were more than 21,000 cases involving what are known as pro se litigants in recent 12-month period. So why are so many people representing themselves in the nation's courtrooms? High legal fees and the Internet are two of the main reasons. Recently, the Wall Street Journal featured a story of Susan Hudock, a Phoenix woman who worked as a drug sales representative for Aventis Pharmaceuticals until she was fired. Hudock wound up arguing her own case against Aventis. Legal experts say Hudock is, her case anyway, is a complicated lawsuit based on the Americans with Disabilities Act. Now, the final outcome of the case is still undecided. The jury did find for the company, but Hudock has filed several motions to overturn the verdict and is seeking a new trial. We spoke with Susan Hudock and asked her why she got fired.
To this day, I really don't know. Supposedly, I got fired because I couldn't drive a car. And it basically, that's what it boiled down to. And I couldn't drive a car because I chose not to drive a car medicated because I had pain from a chronic condition known as shingles.
Mm-hmm.
And being the resourceful individual that I am and wanting so much not to not work or be put on disability or lose my job, I decided to work in pain, but there was one thing I was not willing to do, and that would be get behind the wheel and put anyone in harm's way. So my husband, who is a retired lieutenant colonel from the Special Forces, was very capable and willing to taxi me from appointment to appointment, and I did this for 6 months in 1999, and everything was fine, and I could perform my job.
But the company said they had to let you go because in part it was unfair to other sales reps that you had a chauffeur, in a sense.
In part, that was part of it. Yes, they also made reference to some liability issues. For the life of me, I don't know what they are. This company car becomes the family car because I paid $40 every 2 weeks for personal use. And my husband was approved to drive it, insured to drive it by the company. And we paid $40 every 2 weeks for the privilege. So from a liability standpoint, I didn't quite understand what they were saying.
Well, let's get to the trial itself. Originally, now, you did have a lawyer. What happened to that lawyer, and why did you choose to represent yourself?
Originally, I went to one lawyer who said I had an action against the insurance company because they denied my disability claim. They said, in essence, I wasn't disabled enough to get disability benefits, and my company was saying I was too disabled to work. So I felt like I was between a rock and a hard place. And I also felt this was so tragically, terribly unfair. And so he said, well, you know, I'm very skilled with dealing with the insurance company. I'll take that portion of your case. And then he referred me to another lawyer to take the Americans with Disability Act portion of my case. And I was willing to put my retirement savings, everything on the line to prove that I should not have been fired, that laws were indeed broken. And she was all gung-ho in the beginning. Yeah, you have a terrific case. You have a terrific claim. But as the depositions lingered on and as the cost mounted and piled up, I ran out of money. And when I ran out of money, she said, well, you have to settle. I said, I do. She said, you have no case. I don't. That's news to me. And then at that point, I was really fatigued, and I was really tired, and I thought, well, you know, life is unfair. You know, you just got to accept that, and I did. And I was going to settle for a mere pittance, and I'm telling you, it was a pittance. I was going to settle and put it all behind me. There was one thing that I asked of my company. I asked that my company give me a letter of recommendation, in essence stating I did nothing wrong to be terminated, which was the truth. They refused. And I said, well, I'm not settling. And then she said, well, I'm not going to be your lawyer. And I said, well, that's on you. I need you to be my lawyer. I will pay you in payments, installments. I need you to stay, be my lawyer. Well, she filed a motion in the court to withdraw as counsel, and they filed a motion to compel settlement, and that's when I, you know, I had to protect my name, and I felt, no, wait a minute here. Why are you trying to bury me? This is ridiculous. And that's when I decided that I would fight.
But you had no legal background. Where did you start?
You have to study and see what lawyers do, and the Internet was an invaluable tool. You get into it. You understand their culture. You understand their language. You understand the very ether that they breathe in. And then you try to speak to them in their language and work in their culture and figure out that. And it's something as simple as, you know, how do I format this pleading? And pretty soon your mind becomes, it starts to expand into, okay, now where's their argument? And is it true? You know, I ran out of money. I ran out of lawyer. Sometimes I ran out of strength. But I never ran out of the truth.
But let me ask you, and I don't mean this in a frivolous way at all.
Sure.
We hear so much about the legal system, much of it cynical. Does the truth really count in this kind of a process?
There is some cynicism, and probably well-deserved cynicism. But the thing is, you have to fight for the truth. And if I don't stand up and fight for it in my little world or little corner in my case, then maybe indeed the truth doesn't matter. But to me it does, and I think for a lot of folks it does.
We're speaking with Susan Hudock. She's among an increasing number of Americans who are representing themselves in court. We'll continue the conversation after a break. We'll also get the legal community's view. And later in the show, Ruth Reichel reflects on a life in disguise as a restaurant critic for the New York Times. There's more coming up here and now. We're speaking with Susan Hudock. She's among the growing number of Americans who are representing themselves in court. Susan, legal experts warn against people representing themselves because their emotional connection to their case can distort their judgment.
I agree 100%. I do agree. It would have been far better for me to have an attorney. I'm not saying that it isn't, but it wasn't affordable to me. There are very few attorneys that will take civil rights cases on a contingency basis. So I had to do the expedient thing, and the expedient thing was to work through my case.
Would you do this again?
Would I do this all again?
Yeah.
Yes, I would do this all again, and I would do it for the reasons that I said before. I have to make the stand.
Susan, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Susan Hudock represented herself in a civil lawsuit against her former employer. The jury in her trial ruled against her, but she has three motions now before the court to keep the case alive. To continue our discussion about self-representation, we turn to Jean Charn. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, also director of the Bello Sachs Access to Civil Legal Services Project. Jean, tell us a little bit, what's the general view of self-representation in the legal community?
Well, I think there's more than one view. There's increasingly a view that we have to help people who do this because they're coming to court, they're there, and we don't make available lawyers to help them through the court process. There are, of course, lawyers and judges who see this as not the way courts are supposed to work and would like it to go away.
Well, I can imagine that lawyers would say, no, we don't want to help people do this. This is the last thing we want to do. It's the last thing we want to encourage.
Well, I think there are two parts. One is it's a business proposition for lawyers. They want people to hire them to do these things. But at the same time, it's deep in legal culture that if you take on a case, a lawyer has to do it and do it from beginning to end, and that we have an expertise. So how could a layperson do this? Now, the fact is that lawyers aren't available to help most people, and not all legal problems are so complicated that laypeople couldn't do pretty well on their own. I'm not sure that that was the case with Mrs. Hudak. She had a pretty complicated problem.
She did have a complicated problem, and she was certainly emotionally involved, as you can imagine anybody would be. They are invested in their own case. Obviously, that's a source of great energy, but I can see that that may be a liability as well.
Well, that's one of the reasons why people do need advocates at times, that they're so personally invested that they're not the people who will best present their case to a judge or a jury.
Is there a rule of thumb that would help us tell when we should take on our own case and when we should back off and call in a pro?
I don't think it's conceivable and probably not desirable that we should have full-fledged lawyers on every type of problem. So one of the things that we're recommending and looking at is how to sort out and how to advise people, how to make it easy for them when it's appropriate for them to handle their own legal matter, and when they really need to be directed and get some more expert help. And a few courts that are very innovative are building those kind of centers right inside the courthouse and helping people in just that way.
As a business proposition, I guess it doesn't sound like such a bad idea to branch out a little bit and offer consulting services. It seems to me that you could make legal services available to a broader cross-section of the population if you didn't take the case from beginning to end. In other words, more people could use legal services if it was a partnership and they were paying for only part of the service.
Well, that's exactly right. While I think only a few lawyers are doing this, the trend is in the direction of change. And it's in the direction of change because, bottom line, most of the people who don't use lawyers can't afford good legal services anyway. And what lawyers, some pioneering lawyers, are finding is that there is a market for less than full representation. The choice doesn't have to be turn everything over to a lawyer, let the lawyer handle everything, or do it completely on my own. There are a whole range of gradations, and I think we would have a better system if we own that, specifically supported a range of gradations in which lawyers would play a very important role, but so would lay advisors, paralegals, and some of the things that lawyers do are informational, and the information could be available from lots of places.
If change comes, does it come courtroom by courtroom, or do you see the law schools playing a part in this?
I would hope that law schools can play a part, and certainly my law school is actively supporting this project. But the law schools do teach a formalistic view of law in which all of our role plays, all of our moot courts are two well-prepared lawyers arguing to a judge who acts just the way judges should act with time to hear the case. This is not the court that ordinary people are in, where there is often maybe a very experienced lawyer versus no lawyer, as in this woman's case, or an inexperienced up against a pro. We don't like those lawyers in the abstract. But when we're in trouble, we want a sharp, hard-fighting lawyer on our side. And I think that there's more respect for that than popular culture in the media maybe suggests.
No jokes when we're in trouble with the law.
No jokes when we're in trouble with the law. But the fact is, being in trouble with the law and being on your own in a system that is not welcoming to you at all, that's not a joke.
Jean Charn is a senior lecturer at the Harvard Law School and director of the Bello Sachs Access to Civil Legal Services Project. Okay, so there's these three lawyers, see, and they're in a rowboat, right? And this shark comes up, see? So the first lawyer says, hey, what do you guys think if we go? Tomorrow on Here and Now, whatever happened to summer vacation? Some educators say students perform better in the fall, and an early start to school means improved test scores. Some parents, though, want more time at the beach. The school calendar tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Among those who were rounded up by the U.S. military police in Pakistan in the months following the September 11th attacks were a group of Chinese Muslims known as Uyghurs. The Uyghurs were held first at a military facility in Kandahar, Afghanistan, then transferred to the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. There, the Uyghurs have remained for more than 3 years, even though 6 months ago at least two of them were cleared of all charges against them. Sabin Willett is a Boston-based attorney who represents two of the Uyghurs. It was Willett who found out in July, quite by accident it turns out, that his clients had been cleared of wrongdoing. He joins us in the studio. Welcome, Sabin.
Good afternoon, Frank.
Tell us a little bit about the story. It's a complicated odyssey, but tell us about how the Uyghurs were taken into custody.
Well, we know very little. In fact, we know only what we were able to learn from our clients through interpreters in one meeting at the base in July. But they were seized in Pakistan. We believe a bounty was paid for them of $5,000 a head. They were delivered to U.S. forces, held in Kandahar for about 6 months. In about midsummer of 2002, they were sent to Gitmo, where they've been held in prison ever since.
And what has happened since then? When were you contacted? How long have you been on the case?
At some point earlier this year, a lawyer representing another client at Guantanamo received word that these men wanted a lawyer. It was about at that time that our firm made the decision to get involved in the habeas litigation. We reached out to a group called the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. They were aware of these men's identities, and that's all, because, you see, the government doesn't tell you anything about why people are held at Guantanamo. And so purely by chance, we took their case on in March and filed habeas petitions then. But you still can't talk to them by phone. You can't get a letter through. You don't know anything about them. And it wasn't until July when we'd cleared the security check that the FBI makes that we were actually able to go to the base and find out what had happened.
And it, by then you'd found out almost accidentally that they had been cleared.
Only from them. You see, early in the case, we learned a lot from public sources about Uyghurs, and we suspected that maybe these men had been taken by mistake. We asked the government the question in March, do you contend that they represent a security threat? The government wouldn't answer. We later found out that in March they had been cleared. It wasn't until July that we reached the base and the men expressed to us some puzzlement about why they were still in prison, having been informed themselves that they had been cleared. And they are there today.
And this is a complicated situation and a unique situation in some ways because the Uyghurs, we should talk a little bit about their background, Turkic people who are in China. Tell us a little bit about them and why they can't go home.
The Uyghurs come from an area of the world they call East Turkestan. And when you open your atlas to Asia, it's always in the crease, East Turkestan. It's in Central Asia, the far western reaches of China. And they are there an oppressed minority of the Chinese communists. They have for years struggled for independence without any success. Few people in our part of the world have heard of them. In fact, there is a small but active Uyghur expatriate community in the U.S. Many have been granted asylum. They are passionate lovers of democracy. And it's a true irony that two of their number, in fact more than two, are held in Guantanamo today. But they can't, to answer your question, they can't go back to China where they would be persecuted, and the government recognizes at least that much. What we've said is there's at least got to be an alternative other than a prison in Guantanamo, given that they've been cleared of any wrongdoing. We've suggested civilian parts of Guantanamo in the base. We've suggested bringing them to the District of Columbia where the court is. But the government resists that.
And you've also come up with another fairly interesting precedent that might serve them.
Well, it's interesting. When we were before Judge Robertson, the judge asked the government, what is the basis for holding people beyond the point when you say that they are combatants? And they pointed to a wind-up power that they said the government has inherent to its warfighting power, and they pointed to the history of World War II, when we had in the continental United States prisoners of war, Germans and Italians mainly, and there was a period following the end of the war when it wasn't quite clear what to do with them, which gets us to Louis the Barber, because I was telling this story to one of my partners who says, well, that's funny. Louis the Barber, my barber, recalls Italian prisoners of war walking around the streets of Boston at Liberty. And so we dug into the archives at the library and so on and found that, sure enough, in September 1943, when Italy surrendered but the war was not yet over, there was a problem of what to do with the Italian prisoners of war in South Boston. And what they did was they were released to a barracks, they were given jobs, they were given liberty, they had parades, they had concerts, they had picnics and outings. And we've said that's very different than what's happening to our clients in Guantanamo.
So how has the government responded to the Louis the Barber alternative?
We haven't heard from them on that yet. Yeah. That was in our most recent brief, and we're interested to hear the response.
Do we have any idea how many others at Gitmo are in a similar situation where they've been cleared but the government doesn't know what to do with them?
Frank, it's difficult because the government will disclose nothing about who is at Guantanamo. But we believe that there are about 22 or 3 Uyghurs held in prison. We believe that some 10 to 15 of them at least have been cleared, but there is no assurance that that information is right. And indeed, there are people, we're quite sure, who are held at Guantanamo whose names are not known, who have no lawyer, and yet they remain in prison.
Interesting case with the Uyghurs because the Chinese government considers them more or less terrorist or a terrorist risk because of their independence movement in China. And here they are in Guantanamo Bay, held by the United States government under the same pretense.
Which, at least so far as Secretary Powell was concerned, when he was Secretary of State, there was no suggestion that the Uyghurs were any kind of terrorist or threat to the U.S. Many, many Uyghurs have been admitted under asylum petitions to our country, and there's really no suggestion that these people are anything but friends of the U.S.
Have you been in touch with any of the families of the detainees?
Not directly to their immediate families who remain in China. We know that each of our clients has a child that he's never seen because each left China at a time when his wife was pregnant. We did hear from the sister of our client, Adele. Her name is Kavser, and she is a refugee living in Sweden. Accounts of our case had reached the European press, and she had found out that her brother was a prisoner at Guantanamo. We spoke to her by phone on July 29th and listened to this woman weep because she thought her brother was dead. And as we told the court, in effect, people in Guantanamo are dead. No one knows they're there. There's no way to communicate with the outside world.
So where does the case stand at this point?
Well, the parties had a hearing, as you mentioned, before Judge Robertson on August 1st. There were post-trial briefs filed, and we are now waiting for a decision.
Sabin, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Sabin Willett is an attorney with the Bingham McCutcheon Law Firm in Boston. Still to come, a restaurant in New York does away with tipping. Diners will see a 20% service charge on their checks now. Could more restaurants follow suit? Will diners see a decline in service? You're listening to Here and Now. There are reports today that the Bush administration plans to let big vehicles like Hummers, Ford Excursions, and large SUVs keep their exemption from federal fuel efficiency standards. This as gasoline prices continue their upward surge. Historically, these vehicles have not had to meet mileage requirements. The Bush administration had proposed including the vehicles in fuel economy regulations in December of 2003, but it appears that under pressure from the domestic automakers, administration officials have changed their minds. We're joined by Larry Webster, technical director for Car and Driver magazine. Hello, Larry.
Hi.
Is this a surprise to you? The decision hasn't been formally announced, but are you surprised that they're considering this?
No, not really. I mean, the big three own the big truck market, and imposing the CAFE standard on large trucks would only hurt the domestic automakers.
This CAFE standard, CAFE stands for the standard that would impose fuel efficiency.
Yeah, it stands for corporate average fuel economy.
Yeah.
And basically, there's a bunch of different proposals on the table, but basically it says that you combine all the cars that an automaker sells and that combination has to equal a certain fuel economy number.
Well, what do you think of the decision?
You know, I think it's a good one. I think that I've never thought that CAFE standards were a smart way to increase fuel economy anyway. So I think you kind of got to switch the discussion away from it.
But I can see a lot of folks out there driving around right now saying, what are they doing encouraging people to drive bigger cars when prices are going up and supplies are going down? Doesn't it help? Isn't this a way to help curb oil consumption?
No, because, you know, don't forget, nobody puts a gun to anyone's head and tells them to buy a big truck. It's a choice. And basically what you do with these CAFE standards is you force the automakers to sell cars that people don't want. I mean, clearly there's demand for these big cars. And as any company that sells a product, they should be able to sell what people want.
And I know that you've come out, you have an alternative suggestion that you think might work even better. What's that?
Yes. I mean, we've always thought that fuel economy is very important. We want to reduce our dependence on oil just like anybody else. And the best way to do that is really to make gas more expensive because you have to create the demand for more fuel-efficient cars. And once you do that by raising fuel prices, I mean, I think you'll start to see that the popularity of these large trucks will go away.
Well, fuel prices are rising, and apparently
yeah.
Detroit seems to think there is no limit to the appetite for these things. Have you seen any evidence that people, in the face of higher prices, are moving away from these things?
Well, this has been a crazy summer for the domestics because they cut prices so heavily that it kind of kept this sales boom going through the summer while gas prices were rising. So we don't really have good data that suggests that the rise in gas prices is hurting truck sales just yet. But maybe in the next 6 months, if gas stays around $3 a gallon, I wouldn't be surprised if we do start seeing that trend.
I was going to ask you about that. Do you think $3 is the tipping point?
No, it's a start, but I think, you know, $3.50 to $4 is really when I think people get serious about buying more fuel-efficient cars.
Is there a danger, do you think, in Detroit? I mean, we know that back in the 70s, Detroit was very slow to respond to the spike in oil prices, and as a result, small, efficient cars from Japan took over a big part of the market.
Sure.
Do they need a little boost? Would something from the White House, from the federal government, push them? Would be a 2x4 to say it's about time to think about switching production lines?
Oh, no, they don't need it. They all sell small, fuel-efficient cars. Chrysler does, you know, obviously Ford does with the Focus, and so does General Motors. So, you know, the cars are there. It's just that people tend to want the larger, roomier, more powerful vehicles.
Very briefly, Larry, any sense in Detroit that the automakers are nervous that they might be too slow to respond, that there might be a big spike and they're caught with these production lines for big cars?
You know, it's one of those things I'm glad I don't have to make those decisions because the trucks are very profitable for the car companies. So you don't want to just forget about them and build these small cars because that's where they're making their money.
Right.
But at the same time, you don't want to get caught out if fuel prices, you know, go even higher. So they're trying to walk that line, and some are doing it better than others for sure.
Larry, thanks very much.
Anytime.
Larry Webster is the technical director for Car and Driver magazine. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. The New York restaurant world is abuzz with the news that one of its most exclusive restaurants will be replacing the institution of tipping with a 20% service charge. Thomas Keller says he's taking the step at his Per Se restaurant to benefit dishwashers, cooks, and others who usually don't get a cut of the tips, and he says it'll give all employees a more steady income. But can such an entrenched institution as the tip be changed? Joining me on the line is Stephen Shaw, author of the new book, Turning the Tables, Restaurants from the Inside Out. Stephen, welcome.
Hello.
Now, you wrote in an op-ed piece in the New York Times that you think this is a good idea.
I think it's a great idea. I think it's a long time in coming that we start moving towards the way European restaurants do tips. And, of course, they have better service for lack of tipping.
Well, is that true? I mean, we have the sense that the, you know, waiters are out there working hard, some of them, because they sort of pride themselves on being able to get good tips through good service.
Well, I do think waiters work hard to get good tips. I'm not sure that waiters get good tips because they give good service. Rather, what studies have shown, the academic studies of tipping, have shown that waiters get more for tips if they touch people on the arm, if they draw a smiley face on the check. Men tip women servers more, and women tip men servers more. So it's not necessarily about good service. It's more about hustling for the psychology of getting somebody to give you a big tip.
That said, though, once it's all built into my salary, will there be as much sort of energy and verve in the service of a waiter who is now on salary?
What we hope is that by putting waiters on a salary, that they'll behave more like professionals in any other industry. My background is that I was a lawyer. I didn't get paid with tips. People paid me per hour. And I gave the best service I could because I wanted them to come back, because I had pride in my profession, not because I was hoping for a tip.
What about the argument that that diners themselves look at this as their way to either reward or, better yet, get revenge when things don't go well?
Well, I think most diners, I believe the latest surveys indicate 80% of diners do prefer to have control of the tip. My feeling is they shouldn't. It creates a master-servant relationship between diners and servers where a person who, for any reason, good or not, can control the server's livelihood.
And I suppose there are a lot of reasons outside of the waitstaff's control that in many ways hurt them or in some cases benefit them.
Sure, people will withhold a tip because the steak was overcooked, but of course the server didn't cook your steak, the kitchen did.
Now, that said, there may be a lot of good rational arguments for changing the system, but do you think it'll actually catch on in these United States?
I think that it will take a long time to catch on at the middle market level, but it looks like restaurants at the fine dining level are starting to move in this direction. Not only Thomas Keller's Per Se in New York, but also the famous Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California, and Charlie Trotter's in Chicago have all gone over to this system. And I think it's because they're trying to catch up with the levels of service at restaurants in Europe that have Michelin stars and are internationally regarded.
So you think it might become a status symbol in some of those middle-level restaurants then?
I hope so, and then perhaps other restaurants will follow suit when they see its success at the top levels.
We've been talking to Stephen Shaw, author of Turning the Tables, Restaurants from the Inside Out. The quality of service was often an issue for author Ruth Reichel when she was a restaurant critic for the New York Times. But when she went out to eat, she had to hide her identity from waiters and maitre d's who were hoping for a good review. She's chronicled her experiences in a new book, Garlic and Sapphires, The Secret Life of a Critic in Disguise. And here now foodie Scott Haas caught up with her recently at the Casablanca restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He talked to her about her former life of mystery.
When I was really doing disguises, I thought it was you had to do more than just put on a funny hat and sunglasses, that I really had to invent people and turn into those people.
Now, why did you do that? I mean, why did you have to do that?
Well, when I first got to New York as the restaurant critic of the New York Times, I discovered that every restaurant in New York had a huge picture of me hanging in the kitchen with reward written across it and offers of anywhere from $500 to $1,000 to any waiter who spotted
Seriously?
Me. Seriously.
Wow.
So, you know, if you believe, as I do, that The only real way to review restaurants is to do it anonymously, so you can tell your readers what's going to happen to them, not what happens to the person for whom the red carpet is being rolled out.
I'm wondering how an ordinary person who happens to like food a lot can enhance the experience. They're in a restaurant, things are not progressing in the way that they had anticipated.
One of the disguises that I took on as a restaurant critic was my mother. And becoming my mother was truly terrifying to me for many reasons, not the least of which was that my mother was every restaurateur's nightmare. And I took another old lady to 21. 21 is, you know, one of New York's great old restaurants. It was one of those restaurants that was a speakeasy in the 20s and then turned into a great New York institution. But one of those places where rich people have their own tables in the front. And so Miriam, my mother, and her friend Claudia walk into 21 and are instantly ushered to the very back of the room. With a waiter who makes it very clear that he has no intention of, you know, expending any energy on these two old ladies. And I start channeling my mother, who sends everything back. But not in a peevish way. It's just, these oysters aren't opened properly.
Were these accurate observations?
They were accurate observations. The soup isn't hot enough. There's too much dressing on the Caesar salad. And this waiter very grudgingly gave my mother respect. And as her friend Claudia said, when we finally got outside, she said, that was really, I'm so glad that's over. It was a nightmare. And then she said, but I have to say, tonight, we scored one for every old lady in New York. I think the other part of getting it is do your homework before you go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should know when you walk into a restaurant, you know, what to expect there, what their good dishes are, who the chef is. Be knowledgeable. Don't just go in to a really good restaurant cold.
Right.
And expect it to be fabulous.
You're no longer reviewing restaurants, right?
I am no longer reviewing restaurants.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I loved reviewing restaurants. I mean, you know, the whole time I was reviewing restaurants, I couldn't believe that I was getting away with this, you know. I got to go out for all these great meals. I got to take all my friends out. Somebody else paid for it. You know, you're writing stuff that, you know, as we became more and more of a food culture, people read the columns. So I loved everything about what I was doing, except that as my son got older and older, he kept saying, I wish you didn't go out to dinner every night. And I think it's a perfect job, but not a perfect job for the mother of a young child.
Former New York Times critic Ruth Reichel speaking about her new book, Garlic and Sapphires, The Secret Life of a Critic in Disguise. She spoke with Here and Now food guru Scott Hawes. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Frank Stacio. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Frank Stacio. Join us